So in high school, I was on the wrestling team of my high school. And although it's probably hard to believe, given my impressive physique at the moment, I was not an excellent wrestler. Does anybody want to guess my record freshman year?
Zero.
Close. I think there was a forfeit that I won. It was like 1 in 10 or something. I know, I get some pity there. So. You can't win, at least you get pity, right? So my coach was like, so I was about the same weight I am right now, and I weighed 35 pounds less. I was a skinny little kid. My coach was like, what you need to do is like actually have some muscle, right? Like, that's important for this sport. So he was like, you got to go to the gym, right? So I'm like, all right, fine. So sophomore year, I actually didn't do much better. Then between sophomore and junior year, I started, I was like, all right, I'm going to get strong. I'm going to go to the gym. So I went to the gym, and I started working out. And I started running to get in better shape. How many of you guys work out, run, do stuff like that? Okay. Why? Why do you do that? So you can eat as many cookies as you want. I buy that. That's a good reason. Why else? What's that? You sit around for 8 hours a day. All right, balance it out. Good. What else?
Stand up to bullies.
Stand up to bullies. All right. Ryan lives in a world of bullies. Feel better. Anything else? One last one.
Body image.
Body image. Okay, good. To compete, is that what you said? Nice. Well, we're going to get back to that question. What we're thinking about tonight, though, as we look at this passage in Amos, is what does it look like to be a good Christian? What does being a good Christian look like? And we're going to unpack some ideas around that phrase. This book, and particularly the section we're right now, really challenges what it looks like to live out your faith, what it looks like to have an active faith in God, and how that faith changes the way you live, how it seeps out into your daily activities. And in particular, the passage we're looking at tonight speaks to a group of people whose lives weren't changed enough, whose lives didn't reflect what they should reflect. And yet, they were very religious. They had these strong religious activities. And so we're going to try and figure out how that works. If you remember a little bit of background, Amos is writing to God's people in the northern kingdom. So there's two kingdoms of God's people, this time the southern kingdom named Judah, and the northern kingdom that's referred to as Israel. So Amos is sent to God's people in Israel. He's not a prophet by trade, he's a shepherd, and he gets sent up to that area to speak to people that aren't his own people. And he's speaking to them right before a major tragedy happens to them, right before they get conquered by a foreign nation. So it's kind of like Amos knows this is going to happen, and he's speaking to these people kind of like a coach might speak to his team, right? This difficult thing is about to come. Like, you got to get psyched up. You got to get ready to face this difficult thing. And Amos is trying to help them understand partly why they're about to face this, but also he's trying to prepare them for how to endure, how to suffer through, and how to kind of stay sane through the trials that are about to come. And in thinking about this, I kind of was considering what it's like to be a young adult, and to be in the stage of life that a lot of you guys are in. And realizing that in some ways, Amos is a good book for this group, for this life stage, because you know, life is always hard and there's always complicated things in life. But this stage that most of you are in is kind of, in some ways, it may not feel this way, but a little bit of the calm before the storm, right? I mean, life is complicated. There's a lot of difficult things that are going to happen. There's a lot of struggles. There's a lot of pain. There's a lot of loss. There's a lot of confusion. And this time in your lives can be a time of kind of saying, God, center me now. Center me in this relationship. Before a lot of you will get married, a lot of you will have children, a lot of you will have a lot of things happen in your life that you don't expect. And so this can be a time where it probably doesn't feel like life's simpler, but it is. And it's a unique time then to really say, God, connect me with you, prepare me, give me this foundation of a relationship with you so that as I move into the next stages of life, I'm ready and I'm connected to you and I know what to do. So in that sense, Amos is kind of a good preparatory type book to start asking these questions. We're looking at chapter 5 of Amos tonight. I want to review a little bit. So Amos began and he started out by criticizing the nations around Israel. He started by listing all the sins of the foreign nations. Then he zeroed in on Israel and he focused on their sins and he called them out to say, this is how you're not living the way you ought to live. Last week we looked at how he really challenged God's people with some particular areas that they weren't really living up to God's standards in. This week what he does is he changes the focus a little bit. He doesn't focus as much on what they're doing wrong, but we've had all that kind of in the background. This week he focuses on their false religious activities. He focuses in on their worship, and he says, your worship isn't real worship. And he points out to them why. And so the question that we're trying to get at tonight is, what is real worship? What does it look like to have real, authentic Christian worship? So, when I was in high school, when I started going to the gym, the reason I went to the gym was to become a better wrestler. The reason I wanted to, I'm not sure you can call it bulk up when you have my physique, but go from negative to not negative, right? Was for a purpose. There was this goal to perform better in some athletic endeavor. And what we're thinking about tonight is, what does worship do? What does worship lead to? What does it result in? And what I want to suggest is that real worship, when you're connected to God, when you're really, truly worshiping God, it makes you not just a good Christian, but a good person. Real worship makes you a good person, not a good Christian. And we're going to unpack that a little bit as we go through tonight. So starting in Amos chapter 5, verse 18. If you want to follow along, I'll read. We're going to start with just the first two verses. Amos chapter 5, 18 to 20, the first three verses. Woe to you who desire the day of the Lord. Why would you have the day of the Lord? It is darkness and not light, as if a man fled from a lion and a bear met him, or went into the house and leaned his hand against the wall and a serpent bit him. Is not the day of the Lord darkness and not light, and gloom with no brightness in it? So Amos starts off by talking about this concept of the day of the Lord. And this idea, this image of the day of the Lord, or the day of Yahweh, is an image that occurs repeatedly throughout the prophets. Amos is one of the first ones to start using it and use this as kind of a technical term. But what this idea of the day of the Lord is this is the day that God is going to show up on earth and vindicate himself against his enemies. The idea is that God has created things, he set things in motion, and a lot of people have taken advantage of that. But the day of the Lord is when God comes to town and calls those people into account. So here's another reference to it in Obadiah. This is Obadiah 1:15. It says this, "For the day of the Lord is near upon all the nations. As you have done, it shall be done to you. Your deeds shall return on your own head." So this is where all those people that got away with doing bad things get paid for it. So an example we might think of is like perhaps the next time the 49ers play the Seahawks, right? That's an example of the day of the Lord, when these crazy football players from Seattle get what's coming to them, right? Okay, I promise. That's my last Seahawks reference, all right? Thank you, Liz. So what Amos is saying, though, is that he's saying these guys, these people in Israel, they're wanting the day of the Lord to come. And if you think of yourself as being on God's team, then you would want that, right? Like, all these bad guys are doing things, and you want God to show up and vindicate himself. You want God to show up and show the world that you're in the right, that God is true. What Amos is saying, though, is challenging, because he says, why would you desire the day of the Lord to come. And his point is that this is going to be a terrible day of judgment. And what he says is that you guys think that you're immune from this judgment. But the truth is that God's going to come and judge you. He uses these great images of, you know, you're in the woods and you're running from a lion. You know, remember that last time that happened to you? Right? And you escape the lion, but you get caught by a bear. Right? It's like, dang it, from one to the other. And then you get home, maybe you escape the bear too, you get home and you're like, oh, finally I'm home, and you lean against the wall, and you get bit by a scorpion. Right? So it's this image of like, just when you think something terrible is past, something terrible happens. Just when you think you're safe, something terrible comes to you. And Amos says this because he's trying to get God's people to understand that the judgment of God is a terrible thing. It's a thing to be feared. It's a thing to be respected. It's not the type of thing you wish for. And we have this notion that we're okay. That when God comes, he's going to be on our side. He's going to help all the other people to realize how we've been right all along. But Amos says, that's not the way it works. God's coming to judge you. You also have to be a little bit, you know, occasionally people want marriage counseling, right? We heard about relationships, and you always got to be a little careful of like the person that really, really wants to go to marriage counseling, because what if they're really excited about going to marriage counseling, this is what they expect. They expect to go in the room and the counselor to tell their partner how they've been right all along, right? That's the only reason they really want to go to marriage counseling. But if you go to a good counselor, that's not at all the way it works, right? Marriage counseling or counseling in general, it's kind of like the day of the Lord. I mean, it's a painful, self-reflective, as April helped us see, like, humbling process of saying, this is a relationship. We both bring things to it. You don't go and hear, you know, finally somebody can show my wife or show my husband that I've been right all along, and if they just get in line, everything would be fine, right? That's not the way it works. But that's what God's people seem to want. And so the challenge for us then, the thing for us to think about is, how do we evaluate ourselves? How do we evaluate our relationship with God and like think of ourselves compared to other people? And I think our tendency is to think that God's on our side, that God knows us. He knows our intentions, he knows our heart, and God understands. You know, God is a kind and merciful and loving God. And so he knows why we make the mistakes we make. He forgives us, he's understanding, he's gentle. And these things are certainly true. But it's not as if God doesn't hold us accountable. And when we think of somebody that's on our side, I think what we want is somebody that just goes, rah, 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 you're doing great. Oh, you made a mistake, but don't worry about it. It's not a big deal. You're the best. You're awesome. Keep going. That's what we want. And we think sometimes that that's what God's like for us, but it's not that way. God challenges us. He dives into the deep places of our hearts. And he's on everybody's side. And so the first idea I want us to think about is thinking about our relationship with God simply in isolation from the people around us. Because what we often tend to do is we tend to like look at other people and say, well, at least I'm not doing that. Or at least, you know, I'm not as far gone as that person. Or at least this person is that way and I'm not that. And so we kind of take solace in where we are. That's what God's people are doing. And what Amos says is, no, 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 no. This whole deal is between you and God. Don't think that God's going to judge others. Ask yourself where you're at with God. And so, you know, we are a community of people, and we are together trying to figure out what it looks like to serve God. And we help each other in that, but we can take that the wrong way at times, and we can get in our circle of friends, or our small groups, or our buddies that just kind of reinforce things that are going on in our lives. And the challenge to us is to say, it's me and God. And my spiritual life is my spiritual life. And only God can really call me to account for that. So I don't know your hearts. I don't know where each of you is at with God. I don't know what God is doing, how he's challenging you, how he's growing you, how he's encouraging you. But the place to start tonight is to really ask that question of yourself, to say, where am I with God? Not where am I with my friends or my small group or my Christian peers, but what's going on between me and God? How are things? Real worship begins with your relationship with God. Nobody else is involved. Nobody else comes to play. It's you and God. Real worship begins with you and God. Amos continues then in verse 21, and he starts talking about the activities of worship that these people are engaged in. First, they're doing this thing where they, you know, oh, let's have the judgment of God come, let's have the day of the Lord, and let's have all the nations learn who's really boss. And then Amos challenges them on the things that they're doing and why the things they're doing aren't serving the purposes that they're meant to. So this is it, beginning in verse 21. I despise your feasts, and I take no delight in your solemn assemblies. Even though you offer me your burnt offerings and grain offerings, I will not accept them. And the peace offerings of your fattened animals, I will not look upon them. Take away from me the noise of your songs. To the melody of your harps, I will not listen. But let justice roll down like waters, and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. Amos lists a bunch of religious practices that these people do that they're involved in. He starts off by talking about their feasts and their solemn assemblies. The feasts are the like regular, three times a year, people would go up to Jerusalem and they would engage in these huge religious celebrations. They were basically grand parties that you would do that lasted about a week at a time. Solemn assemblies were times where they would gather and be more reflective, times where they would learn, times where they would pray. And so these are the events that mark out their religious life. These are the things that you attend as a religious person. That's where Amos starts. Then he goes on and he talks about their sacrifices, the burnt offerings, the grain offerings. And he says, I'm not going to accept those. I'm not going to accept those from your hand. These are the things that you give up to be a religious person. The sacrifices you make. The things that you give of yourself that say, this marks me as a religious person. In ancient Israel, these were actual sacrifices you brought from your property, from your crops, from stuff that you grew, from your animals. That's the second thing. And God says, those things aren't pleasing to me. The third thing then is he says, don't sing those songs that you sing to me. I'm not listening. I don't want to hear your harps. I don't want to hear your words of praise. The words that come out of your mouth that you claim to offer me praise, I don't buy it. These are the things that we say about God, the words we use to describe, to speak to God, the prayers, the songs, the worship music. So events, the things we attend, the things we sacrifice or give up, and the praise, the words we use. And if we think about what does it mean to be a Christian, what does it look like to be a Christian in our culture? Those three categories really do capture a lot of what it means, right? At least on the surface. We go to things, right? We attend things. What do we attend? What are the religious things that we attend?
Church,
yeah. What else?
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Retreats.
Small group, retreats.
Ministry.
What's that?
Ministry.
Yeah, ministry activities. We go and help out places. Yeah, so a lot of our Christian life is defined by the things we attend, right? Oh, you go to church. You must be a Christian, right? Your attendance marks you out as a Christian. So that's one of these categories. Did anybody go to a church growing up that like actually had like attendance awards? I did. I think in like some middle school, I won like the Sunday school attendance award for perfect attendance that year, you know? Attendance is important. This is the way we mark things out, right? The things we go to. Second category is the things we sacrifice, right? And so, what are some of the things that we sacrifice or give up as Christians?
Our money?
Our money, yeah. We give money.
instant gratification.
We give up instant gratification, yeah. What else?
Time.
Time, right. Help out with things. What's that?
Fitting in?
Okay, yeah. Yeah. So social situations?
Sex.
Thank you, yeah. Yes. Sexual ethics.
Rock and roll.
Drugs. Rock and roll. Don't play music around Andrea, apparently. Somebody sacrificed these couches. I can't imagine why, but they donated them to the church. So yeah, we give up things, right? I know of churches that actually, like, in their bulletin, they will list how much money people give to their churches, right?
Like actual individuals?
Yeah. 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 Right. Yeah. I know. So you think we should start doing that? What do you think about that? Yeah, I don't think so either. But yeah, we give up things, right? This marks us as a Christian. We sacrifice money, time, sex, drugs, couches, whatever it is, right? We give up stuff for God. And the last thing is that the things we say, the things we do, the words we use, the music we sing, these are things that we do as Christians, right? We sing worship music. We pray. We use certain words. This is the stuff they talk about, right? Christianese. You almost have to learn a new language to be part of a new community because we say things like, have a blessed week, and you know, stuff that nobody else in the world says. We use this language and we do things. And you know, I think that if you think about worship music and just the experience of singing worship to God, it's a uniquely Christian thing, right? I mean, you get together and you sing. And particularly in settings where, like, the worship experience is significant, which it is for a lot of people, there's all these, like, levels, right? I think, Natalie, you might have been the one that sent me this originally, but have you guys seen this? The official worship signals? You guys know about this? So if you're worried about your Christian status, this is like the levels of how good a Christian you are based on what your hands do during worship. So, like, you know, there's like the there's like the elbow flap is like the rookie worship, you know, like you're not too into it. And then there's the, like, this is called go big screen, apparently, you know, just like hands right here. You're like, okay, I'll do my hands, but not too crazy. Then there's like the intermediate levels. This is like right around here, right? Hold my baby. There's one. It's like this. And then there's the Mufasa, right? Apparently. Then you go to the third level, which is pro, and then your, like, hands are a little bit higher. You do, like, the dueling light bulbs, I guess? Something like that? I don't know. I haven't seen that one. Goalposts, right? Right here. Yeah, we're PBC, so we're way past our level here. Then there's the pointer and the hatchet and the schoolroom. And this is the expert, and this one says, warning, Baptists, do not attempt. I would say PBC attenders. There's the village people, which is this, and the Rocky, and the touchdown, right? So this is like what we do, right? We have these worship experiences, and like how much you're engaged in worship is this indication of like how serious and how radical and how committed a Christian you are. And what Amos says to these people is, don't sing those songs. They don't count. They're not important. I don't want to hear them. And the question we have to ask then is why? Like, why would God criticize these things? Why would he criticize these events that he's actually commanded them to attend? Why would he not accept sacrifices that he has told them to bring to him? And why would he say, don't sing me songs about me, when in other places he seems to like that idea. He seems to tell us to offer him praise. So what's going wrong for these people? Why are all these things not working? And Amos answers the question in the final verse of this section where he says, let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. The issue is not that they were doing these things wrong. The issue is not that they were attending the wrong things or attending with the wrong spirit. It's not that they were not doing the sacrifices right. It's not that they were giving poor sacrifices or the wrong sacrifices. It's not even that they were singing the songs wrong. God wasn't saying, you're not lifting your hands enough, so I don't want to hear your songs. The problem is not with the Christian activities themselves. It's with everything else in their life. The problem is that their life wasn't changed by those things. That was an isolated experience. They were following God in this one narrow time frame, but it didn't do anything anywhere else. Let's say that in high school, I start running, I go to the gym, I bulk up, you know, I'm this huge, massive, skinny guy, and I run, and I'm in great shape, and so now I'm like prepared to win wrestling matches, right? Which has, up to this point, been an unknown experience for me. And I go on the mat, and I'm like, well, I'm tired, and I lie down. And I get pinned, right? Not that that ever happened, but what's the point? What's the point of working out? What's the point of getting in shape? What's the point of running? Those events, those activities don't matter unless they're for a purpose, unless there's some greater goal. And so what God is saying, what Amos is criticizing these people for, is they're working out, they're building their muscles just to have big muscles, not to do anything productive with them. They're praising, they're giving sacrifices, they're doing this Christian, for them, Jewish stuff, but it doesn't lead anywhere. It doesn't result in anything. And so the second point is that real worship isn't about the worship itself. Real worship is about your life. Real worship plays out in the lifestyle decisions you make. Letting justice roll down. And there's, you know, I think sometimes we worry in worship and in church settings. It's like, what's my motivation for like going to small group? Or what's my motivation for going to YAF? Or we like self-analyze in a worship experience, right? I want to be into it enough. I want to like be caught up in the moment. And we think about wanting authentic worship and to have this powerful emotional experience during worship. What Amos is saying is that authentic worship has nothing to do with your emotional state while you sing songs to God. Authentic worship has nothing to do with your emotional state while you sing songs. Authentic worship has to do with how you live your life when you're done singing those songs. That's what makes your worship authentic. You come to YAF, you come to church, you go to other events and you sing. It doesn't matter what you feel while you're singing. I mean, yeah, it's nice to be into it. It's nice to have powerful emotions. What matters is what you do when that's done. Is whether that time connecting with God, connecting with other people, prepares you for anything else. Sets you up to live your life a different way. If I say to my wife, I love you, dear wife, and if I don't feel it, right? Let's say I'm just saying those words. Maybe I'm really mad at her. Maybe she just annoyed me or something. But I say, I love you, wife, right? I'm not into it. But I say those words. Does she care? Wives? Women? Eh? Right? Let's say I really mean it, okay? Let's change the scenario. Let's say I really mean it. In that moment, I'm overcome with powerful, passionate, complete love for my wife. And I say, I love you, dear wife. And I mean it. The depths of my heart. And I'm so enraptured by my wife. And then I go on a business trip and I hire a prostitute. But I meant it when I said it to her, right? I mean, that's what's important, right? It doesn't matter what I do when I'm away. It matters if I mean it when I say it to her, right? No. It matters the whole package, right? The whole relationship. You're always married to this woman. It matters how you act when you're not around each other. That's what's really important. So the point of all this Christian stuff is not to be a good Christian. And in fact, I think it's really dangerous. It's really easy to get caught up in like, did I read my Bible today? Did I go to YAF? Did I go to Bible study? Am I praying enough? But all those things are just workouts for life. The real question is, am I loving the people around me? Am I sacrificing? Am I willing to be humbled again and again and again? Am I giving of myself? How do I react when somebody wrongs me? And the point of being in a fellowship group, the point of going to church, the point of connecting with God, the point of centering yourself in scriptures on a regular basis is so that you're prepared for those other moments. The point is not to do those things. The point is that those things are a preparation for living your life to the glory of God. Real worship is lived. It's not practiced. So real worship begins with you and God. It begins with this personal relationship. Real worship flows out of your life. It's something that is lived every minute of every day. It's not an experience at church. Finally, Amos talks about what is about to happen to these people. Amos 5, 25 to 27. He starts off by going back to a previous time in their lives, in the life of the nation, and then he goes forward. He says, "Did you bring me sacrifices and offerings during the 40 years in the wilderness, O house of Israel? You shall take up Sikuth your king and Kiyan your star god, your images that you made for yourselves, and I will send you into exile beyond Damascus, says the Lord, whose name is the God of hosts." Now, there's a little bit of confusion about what Amos is talking about here, but this is how I understand it. This is what I think he's doing. He's basically talking about three different times in the lifespan of these people, of the people of God, of the nation, and these spans themselves cross generations. He begins by saying, "Did you bring me sacrifices and offerings when we were in the desert together those 40 years?" And the implicit question is no, that wasn't a season where they were doing regular offerings. There were some, they had a tabernacle, but it wasn't anything like the formal sacrificial system once they had a temple. But that was a powerful, intimate time between God and his people. He fed them daily with food that fell from the sky. When they made mistakes, the ground opened up and wrought judgment on them. They saw God. They spoke with him. They saw the cloud descending on the tabernacle. So his point is that, remember back to one of the most intimate times that we spent together. There were no offerings. There were no sacrifices. It's not about those things. It's about our connection. It's about being centered with God, being in a relationship with God. And those things contribute to it, but the real thing is the relationship. So he reminds God's people first of this intimacy that they had with them. And then he says, "But now you're all enamored by these other gods, Sikuth and Kiyun, your star god. You're confused, you're worshiping idols, you don't know what's going on, you're rebelling from me, and I'm going to let you. I'm going to let you go your own way. I'm going to let you make your own decisions. Because that's what I do. That's what God does for us. He gives us space. He gives us the freedom to make really bad decisions, if that's what we choose." And so he talks about this time of confusion and this time of rebellion for God's people. And then he says, what's coming is a time of exile. I'm going to send you into a really difficult season of suffering, of loneliness, of isolation, of wondering where I am. I'm going to send you away into exile because of what you've done. And so he's kind of talking about what was, what is, and what's going to be. He's talking about these three seasons that God's people have gone through. Seasons of intimacy, of close connection with God. Seasons of confusion and rebellion. And seasons of suffering and pain. And so I think it's helpful for us then to think about how we walk through different seasons like that. We go through times of intimacy. We go through times where we feel like God speaks to us, where often this is when you're a new believer. Sometimes there's seasons of it just kind of sprinkled throughout your life where you feel like, man, everything's just clicking with God. Like, things make sense. I'm praying. I'm learning. I can pay attention during Paul's long sermons. Like, everything's working, right? Like, God and I are tight. And then there's other times where that's not true. You're confused. You're like, boy, I wish it were like that back then. I wish it were like when God was so real, when it seemed like he fed me every day with food falling from the ground. But that's not the way anymore. And I'm confused by these idols. I'm confused by the world I live in. I'm confused by all the stuff around me. Maybe I'm rebelling in some ways. Maybe I'm toying with other things. But it doesn't make sense like it used to. We go through seasons like that. All of us do. And we go through seasons of suffering, seasons of pain, where tragedy happens, where something, we lose our job, we lose a friend, there's illness, we lose a family member. Relationship that used to be strong is now strained, and we say, why is this happening? Why, God, do you seem so far away? I'm not just confused, but I'm angry, and I'm lonely, and I'm wondering, why am I here? Why are these things happening to me? But what God is saying, and what he's pointing out through Amos, is that through all those things, God is there. God is the one that we're intimate with when we're close to him. God is the one that's standing by watching when we're confused and where we can't figure out what's going on. And God is the one overlooking us, sometimes sending us into exile, sometimes bringing suffering on us, but not always. Sometimes suffering is just the result of a broken world. But regardless of what it is, God is the one that's there overseeing that, protecting us, but allowing us to go through things. Think about, for you, just take a moment for yourself and think about which one of those three categories you might fall into right now. Season of intimacy, a season of confusion, or season of suffering. What's been true for you most lately? And each of those seasons, it looks really different to relate to God. And the fact that things change and we go through these different seasons can sometimes be very disconsoling, dissettling, unsettling. We feel like, well, it was supposed to be like that, and if it's not like that, it must be gone. God must not be real or something else. You know, we start to doubt. We start to wonder. What Amos is saying, though, is that God is the same through all of that. So the third idea here is that real worship persists through the seasons. And if you've walked with God for some time, and as you walk with God longer, you'll realize that these seasons come and go. That there were times of intimacy, and there probably will be times of intimacy. There will be times of confusion if you haven't experienced that yet, but those times will pass. And hard things will happen, and your life will involve suffering that I guarantee you will surprise you. But God's going to be there through them, and those times won't destroy you. God is there. And so the trick then is to allow worship to carry you through, even when it's confusing, even when it hurts. The trick is endurance, persistence, perseverance. And that's a really, really unpopular thing in our culture in particular, because perseverance is the one thing in life you can't get at quickly. By definition, right? I mean, we like things that you can get in the moment. And it used to be you couldn't get rich quickly, but now you can, right? You've got one great idea, and your company gets bought for $1 billion. Like, almost everything in life you can do quickly now, except persevere. Perseverance takes time. It takes sticking through it. But real worship, real connectedness with God, carries you through those seasons. Has anybody played that game Flappy Bird? Yeah? All right, what, how far have you gotten?
I haven't gotten past the first.
See, number one. It's hard, right? What?
25, it's in the elite.
That's ridiculous. Okay, you have to try this game. It's like the hardest, most ridiculous, simplest, most infuriating iPhone, Android game there is. You just have a bird and you like press the screen and it flaps, but you're trying to get past these like Mario tubes. And this is what came to me when I thought of perseverance, because it's just like, the only way to get good at this game is just to play it over and over and over again and fail over and over and over again. And it's incredibly infuriating. But if you stick at it, you could be a Flappy Bird champion. Except for Anita. And this is the way the Christian life works. This is what it looks like to follow God. It's a process of perseverance, of sticking with it, of riding out the seasons and seeing what God has next for you, and trusting and knowing that God is there all throughout them, even when it doesn't seem like that's the case. So real worship carries you through the seasons. It persists. It's perseverance. So the good news is about my story is that I did become a better wrestler, actually. I was never great. You know, I went from like yards below average to like inches above average, right? So it's good, right? Worked out, got a little muscle. I proved that if you work hard at something, you can improve. Funny thing is, like, when I started running in high school to become a better wrestler, my dad started running with me. He's like, all right, my son's running, I'll run with him. He'd never run in his life. He was maybe 52 or something. He'd never, like, done hardly any athletics. And then, like, wrestling season went over, and I'm like, great, I'm done running. Who wants to run, right? I hated running. My dad kept running. And he, like, kept running a lot. And then he ran, like, I forget the number. It's ridiculous. Like, 30, 40 marathons. I mean, crazy, like, obvious psychosis level of running, right? Now, the analogy kind of breaks down because running is actually good for you, but, like, to me, it's just ridiculous, right? It's like, why run that far for no purpose? You're not gaining anything from it, right? And this is what Amos is talking about, these Christian things, this judgmentalism, these Christian activities. Why do things if they don't matter, if they don't reflect in some other sphere of your life? Think about your worship. Think about what it means for you personally to worship God. Real worship starts with you and God, with your relationship with Him. Does yours start there? Real worship is lived, not just practiced. Is your worship, is your faith something you live out? Something that shows itself in your life, in your relationships with your coworkers, in the way that you spend your time and your money, in who you spend time with? Does your faith get played out? Does your worship get lived out in your family relationships, in your friendships, in your romantic relationships? And what about persistent? Real worship persists through different seasons. Does yours? Does your worship carry you through different seasons of intimacy, of confusion, of suffering, of bouncing back and forth, of sometimes feeling like God is so close you can touch Him, and sometimes thinking this whole God thing is a sham? Real worship carries you through all of those ups and downs. Does yours? I'm going to close with what Amos said to God's people just before the passage we read. This is in the beginning of chapter 5. I'm going to read two verses that kind of are echo verses of one another. One is about the people's relationship with God, and one is about how they live their life. This is Amos 5, verses 5 and 14. And then we'll finish with a few more songs. Amos 5, verse 5. God says this, "Seek me and live. Seek God and live. But do not seek Bethel. Do not enter Gilgal or cross over to Beersheba." These were areas of false gods, of idols. "For Gilgal will surely go into exile, and Bethel shall come to nothing. Seek the Lord and live." And then in verse 14, Amos says, "Seek good and not evil, that you may live. And so the Lord, the God of hosts, will be with you as you have said. Hate evil and love good, and establish justice in the gate." Seek God and let your life bear that out.